Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And if you are wondering why this intro sounds a bit different, well, there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is that I'm testing out some new portable recording gear, and I've got no idea if it's going to work, but so far, so good. And the other reason is I'm actually recording for the first time outside. So I'm in Wales. It's bank holiday weekend. It's the first time that me and the fam have been back to Wales, back home, in over a year, and I'm currently sat in my mum's garden. I'm looking at the Welsh mountains and the sun is setting, and you can probably hear the birds chirping, and it is just bloody lovely. And today is a good day, and I hope wherever you're listening to this, I hope you're having a good day too. I'm introducing episode 16, which is with Tasha Danvers. So Tasha is a British athlete who competed predominantly at the 400 metre hurdles, and she competed at sort of all the major tournaments, really, the European Championships, the World Championships, the Commonwealth Championships, where she won silver in 2006. She's also a two-time Olympian and an Olympic bronze medal winner at 2008 in Beijing. So her first Olympics was 2000 in Sydney. Then she missed 2004 at Atlanta for reasons that we're going to chat about on this podcast. But she went for a hell of a lot during that period. It was a really, really tough time. And she overcame a hell of amount of adversity to get to Beijing. And she got to the final and she won the bronze medal. She ran the fastest race of her life to get there after everything she'd been through. And that's amazing. And then she was all set for 2012 London, which would be her hometown Olympics. And yeah, once again, she had some more adversity to get through, and things got pretty tough. And yeah, we're going to talk about it as well during this chat. So out of the two Olympics she made, it's actually the two that she didn't go to where the kind of story gets a little bit different, a little bit challenging, very much inspiring. And it's a great tale. And I'm going to let Tasha tell it. I'm not going to give you too many spoilers here, but it's really, really good. And it's a fascinating insight into an athlete at that level. I mean, we're talking about Olympic finals, Olympic medals here. So, you know, it's incredible, really. And Tasha was just lovely. She's so open, she's so honest, and she's just such a good talker. She's really, really fun. That really, really comes across. We had a real laugh with it, which is a strange thing to say on a mental health podcast. But she was just so nice. And we talk all about all sorts of stuff. We talk about, isolation with, on the athletics track with athletes at that level. We talk about all different aspects of mental health and how to manage it. We talk about antidepressants. We talk about media scrutiny. We talk about backlash. We talk about competition, mindset, all these sorts of things. There's a bit in it where Tasha talks about getting out in front in relation to mental health, and she kind of talks about mental health and being an athlete and all that sort of stuff, and that is just like brilliant. The way she sums it up, the way she talks about it, was something I hadn't really heard before, I suppose, and it's definitely a technique that I'm going to kind of put in place when it comes to looking after myself. Yeah, definitely. So yeah, keep an ear out for that. And if you want to know a bit more about Tasha, www.tashadanvers.com. If you'd like to follow her on Instagram, it's at Tasha the Olympian. And if you'd like to follow her on Twitter, it's at Tasha Danvers. I'm going to put a link in the notes to an article the BBC did about her a few years back, because it's very well written, and it's got a bit of insight into some of the things that we talk about but didn't go too deeply into during our chat. And I'm also going to put a link to the YouTube where they've got the 2008 final in the 400 metre hurdles where Tasha won her bronze medal, because it's so good to watch, it's just sport at the highest level. It might be more impactful at the moment because we haven't got crowds and stuff like that, but to see a stadium full of people and it's a proper Olympic final, you know, with the tension beforehand and the crowd roaring and the commentators going mental, and you know, when you know everything that Tasha went through to get to that point, and when you know everything that she's going to go through after that point, then it just makes it so powerful to watch. And I've watched it a few times in prep for this and since, and goosebumps a lot. It's absolutely fantastic. Give her a follow, give it a listen, check it out, like and subscribe and all that sort of stuff. And if you want to leave me a review on Apple, that would be very much appreciated. So episode 16 of the Proper Mental Podcast with two-time Olympian and bronze medal winner Tasha Danvers. So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast, and today I'm joined by Tasha Danvers. How are you, Tasha?
I'm excellent. How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Very good. And how's where are you at with the pandemic over in LA at the moment, mate? Are you
They go back and forth. Some days it's like at its worst, according to the news, and other days it's like go outside, have fun, splash around at the beach. So I just have every day as usual.
Make the most of it, right, in between all the different changes.
Exactly. Cool.
So I think if it's okay to just jump straight in and chat a bit about you, Tasha. How did you get into athletics? When did all that sort of stuff start for you, mate?
Well, both my parents were athletes, so they weren't doing athletics when I started athletics myself. By that time, you know, they were grown up doing adulting things and all that jazz. but the talent was there, but it was through school. So you do sports in school, you have your sports day, you know, someone raises an eyebrow, no, she's not too bad, that one, let's see what goes from there, I think you should join a club, and then the next thing you know, you're an Olympic medalist. So
just like that. Was there a point that I've often wondered this about, you know, athletes at the highest level, was there a kind of a point, because when we start stuff as kids, you just do it, right? You just do it because it's fun. Yeah. But was there a point where you kind of realized, oh, hang on a minute, I'm pretty good at this, you know?
I always just did it because I was good at it, right? So I never really thought, okay, one day I'm gonna be this or that. I think it kind of, as it's always like almost like a conveyor belt, as I won one thing, it was like, okay, you've made the team for this thing, and then I wanted to win that thing. So it might be school sports day, wanted to win that, won that, then it's like you go on to the inter counties or whatever they call it, and then the next thing you know, they want you to represent the country, then you go to an international competition, maybe against Scotland, England, Ireland, you know, Wales, and then you want to win that, and then you represent Great Britain somewhere against the world, and you're like, okay, I want to win that, and it kind of just built itself in that respect, in terms of my motivation.
Yeah, sure. And then I suppose after a while, you know, you keep winning things, and then certain words start getting mentioned, right? Like, you know, Commonwealth Games and World Championships, and starts heading
Europeans,
in
Olympics and so on. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, fantastic. And so am I right in thinking it was kind of we're sort of coming up to Athens, and that's where your story takes a bit of a diversion, right? That's where things get a little bit different.
Yeah, so 2000 was my first Olympics. It was, you know, I'm a spontaneous, bubbly, fun type of person, but at the same time I'm very laid back in that respect. So I was going into the Olympics sort of like, hey, what's the big deal, guys? You know, it's the same one lap around the track, 10 hurdles, why is everyone getting so you know, excitable? It's another competition, isn't it? So that's kind of how I was. And that was the first time when I went out into that stadium in Sydney, and there's 110,000 people. I was like, okay, this is a little different, guys. Probably biggest championship before that would have been World Juniors, and I don't think there was anywhere near that many people in the stands. And that's when it kind of clicked in my head, oh my gosh, there actually is a thing Called the Olympic Spirit, and you feel it when you go out into that stadium, and you feel it when you're in the Olympic Village. And so that was my first experience, and it was the first time that I made an Olympic final. And actually, there were three of us competing for Great Britain at that time, which was quite rare. It was quite rare in the UK to have three people eligible to make the team in the 400 meter hurdles, because Sally Gunnell, who won the gold medal in 1992, was the only person in the history of Great Britain to have made a women's 400 meter hurdles up until that point. So that was like it was rare for three of us to have that opportunity. Fortunately, for through talent, through training, through everything that it takes, I was able to then go on to the final. So I made it out of the heat, made it out of the semi, made it to the final. I was the only one. So I was really that was really a sort of a pivotal moment in my career as an athlete. It's my first time making a final, and I'd made the final in Kuala Lumpur in 1998, but it was a straight final. Like, it was only six people there, so it's not quite the same. This is the first one I had to fight my way to, and so that kind of gave me like, you know what, I was last, which I was eighth place, but I ran a personal best eighth place. So you know, when you put it in perspective, I ran the best time I'd ever run in my life. So it was really like, I think that's when I realized, okay, I could actually get on that podium, and that became my goal at that point. So I was training, you know, going to all the competitions in between that nobody ever remembers are happening. Europeans, Commonwealth Games, Worlds, all that good stuff. And 2003, I believe I was number six in the world, number one in the UK. So the trajectory was right, spot on, bang on place to do a really good job in Athens in 2004. But then in 2004, I was pregnant. I didn't know I was pregnant, but I was pregnant. So that kind of just threw my whole brain, everything out of whack, because it wasn't planned, obviously. You know, as many female athletes will tell you, or may not tell you, because a lot of female athletes won't want to admit necessarily. But the thought is, well, do I keep this pregnancy or not? Like, I'm like literally right there. It's like you can see your goal, you're in pole position, you're in the perfect shape, you're at the perfect age, like everything is all set, and then this is kind of like, what do you do? But at the same time, I'm married, I'm a wife, you know, like this is also normal life as well, and there is life outside of sports. So it's a tough choice, and you know, a lot of women choose to terminate, a lot of women don't, but it's a question that female athletes you know, have come up against a lot. And it's a real challenge, because you don't know if you do have a kid, you know, in the middle of your career, especially if you're in great shape at that time. You don't know how you're going to come back. You don't know if you're going to come back the same body. You don't know if your whole, like, my abs split apart. So, you know, you don't know what's going to become of it. Will you be sick? Will you be healthier? You have no clue. It's like a big, massive question mark. So having a kid at that stage in your career is a huge, huge risk, a huge, huge question mark. Anyway, I decided that I would keep my son, and that meant obviously 2004 was out of the question. It was really tough, because there was a lot of backlash, I would say, from people in the sport, particularly higher up at the time. In fact, one of the journalists that I spoke to around that time said to me, yeah, some of the stuff that was said about you, you know, whether you were serious about the sport was so bad I couldn't even write
Wow.
it. And you and I both know the British press is not a lot they won't write.
No, that's very true.
So for them to say it
Wow.
was so bad they couldn't write it, that like says a lot. And so it was very devastating to me, because obviously I do care about the sport. I'd been in it. At that time, I think I was 26. I'd been in sport at least from 13, so I'd been out there in the sleet, rain, snow, training, freezing my hands off. You know, all sorts of things to have the career that I had. So that was a bit of a slap in the face. It felt like lots of days crying, and you know, there just came a point where I said I made a decision that even though I had been by some people sort of dismissed, like, okay, well, she's done now. I said, I get to decide. That's my decision. I get to choose. And I think in the back of my mind, I also didn't want to have my child, who is a son, which I didn't know at the time, to grow up and wonder, well, I'm the reason my mother didn't pursue her. That's a lot of weight to carry. And the
it
way
really is.
The way the world is now, he would have round that out, right? Because the internet saves everything. So yeah, it took a turn at that point. But I think it also, you know, career-wise, you could say it's a negative. It took a negative turn in terms of I didn't get to pursue what I had planned. But at the same time, it had a positive turn because it gave me more drive, more focus, and to realize how much I really did want to get on that podium. Like, because, you know, when you so you never know what you've got till it's gone. So now the possibility was taken away from me. It really hit home. And my husband at the time was a coach for the Saudi Arabian track team, and I had to watch him there at the games, coming out at the parade, at the opening parade. And I thought I was cool. I'm like I said, I'm laid back. I'm like, okay, I'll go to the next one. No big deal. And I saw him going out, him still able to go out and be there, and I just fell apart. Like it just really hit home that I had not been able to accomplish that. So yeah, 2004 was a little bit of a ride.
Yeah, sure. It's incredible, really, that you know, people forget, don't they, when you're like an athlete and you know you dedicate to this sport, people forget that behind the athlete there's a human being, you know, and all the things you just described, all those emotions you must have been feeling, that must have been awful. And you know, the fact that people can't, you know, people can't look past and see that and have to feel that they need to put the boot in, so to speak, and stuff like that. That's rough, man. That's really rough. Hey, it's not cool.
It can be. And that's why a lot of athletes, like if you look up, I think I looked up the other day how many Olympians had committed suicide. I think it was over 130, and many more in mental health issues and depression. One you may know, Jack Green, very well known, his struggles with depression. And it's something that a lot of athletes, because of their being an athlete and we're always kind of viewed as a superhero almost, you know, you don't want to admit that you're going through those struggles, number one, because everyone sees you in a particular way. And number two, because you also still have a job to do, and you wonder, you know, what will my competitors think if they know that I'm going through all this? Like, you still have to compete against people. So it's a really challenging spot to be in. And I think there was a time, like you said, when I just got sick of being Tasha the athlete. You know, I wanted to be I wanted to be Tasha the human being as well. You know, I really, to the point I literally despised talking about athletics, because I had been in it so long, by this point probably over a decade and a half, and nobody would ever say, hey Tasha, how are you? Never. No one asked me, how are you, Tasha? People would always say, hey Tasha, how's training going? Right.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
really began to resent that. Like, no one cares about me outside of sport. And that's, you know, like you said, we are human beings, and it's tough. Fortunately, it comes with the territory, that. But I think sports in general are getting better at demonstrating the challenges that athletes have with mental health and bringing it more and more to the forefront, so that athletes don't have to commit suicide. Like, even Antonio Pettigrew, they suspected, I believe, that he had committed suicide. He was found dead in the back of his car, and many, 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 many more stories. If you go on the internet, literally probably from every Olympics, there's at least one person. So it's a tough, tough spot. And like you said, athletes are seen sort of almost as machines sometimes, and it's difficult.
Yeah, and I suppose this, because of the stigma around mental health, there's so many reasons as an athlete why you can't say things. Because I think something that's really common, like with any job when it comes to mental health, is that you can, you know, you can deal with depression, anxiety, you can deal with all these illnesses and still function and still get stuff done. But not everyone understands that, right? So you're thinking about like selection for these big competitions. And, you know, if I say how I'm feeling, is it going to affect how people see that? And there's always this like, this big picture that people don't really understand, I think, that means that we can't be truly honest about how we're feeling, right?
Absolutely. And in my experience, I mean, it took me, because I don't like to necessarily ask for help just in general, right? I like to be able to do things on my own. And it took me like every bit, like I had to weeks, like just, okay, I'm going to tell someone what I'm going to say. And then when I did, because of who I am, it was like almost rushed off. It was like, I said, I don't think I'm doing very well. Like I'm really struggling. I'm not doing well. It took me a lot to just say that to a friend. And I at this time I'm a public speaker, motivational speaker. Like you said, I'm functioning. I'm going out. I look like I'm happy. And then I go home and I don't go outside unless it's for training. But the response to me was, "You're Tasha Danvers, you'll be fine." And that devastated me because I was like, if that's how I'm going to be seen, I'm going to have to figure this out on my own. And I don't have the tools, don't have the skill set. I've never been here before. I don't know what this is. I don't know what to do. And so the good thing is I didn't stop there. I then went and spoke to the sports doctor, the team doctor. Someone who had probably a bit more experience than my friend with these types of issues, but he was then like, oh yeah, no big deal, we'll get you some antidepressants and you'll be good to go. And he's like talking about all the people who have been depressed, and we're talking like world record holders, Olympic gold medalists, like all like this, like tons of people. And I'm just like, what is this, some kind of secret society or something? Of I mean, it would have been so cool to kind of know that prior, because I probably wouldn't have taken so long to go out and have the confidence to speak about it. But it was good to know that it wasn't, it's not that it wasn't a big deal, but I wasn't alone. I think that's really what it was. I wasn't alone in my issue and my journey. And because of that, and because they already had a experience in history, it was like, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll work it out. So I think the real message in that is, yes, it takes courage to speak up, but you must. I think one of the most detrimental things that made it perpetuate was me isolating myself. You want to isolate yourself when you feel that way, but you have to get out. You have to force yourself to speak to someone, doctor, friends, and if they don't give you what you need, keep moving on, keep trying until you get the help you need. It's you have to do it.
Completely. Yeah, that's a really awesome way of putting it as well. And funny you should mention like isolating yourself there. And we've been doing this podcast for a little while now, and we seem to find, regardless of people's, gender, background, work, anything at all, there are certain themes that keep coming up. And one of them is isolation. And I was thinking about your sport. And yeah, all right, you've got like coaches and a team and stuff like that. But when you're on that track, Tasha, right, it's just you. And was it quite lonely sometimes being an athlete like that?
It can be, especially like for me, I was training and competing. I was My base was in Los Angeles, but I'm from Great Britain. So when the season would open up, I would go to Europe. So that doesn't mean that I bring my whole training crew with me. So it could be lonely in terms of like I'm training by myself. I don't have my coach there, and I'm very much a people person. So I like the energy of having other people around. I remember a time, and I tell this story often, when I was getting ready for 2008. I'd come back to Europe. I was in London, and I think I was at Ladywell, the track in Ladywell. And it was just one of those days where it was overcast, it was drizzly, and not one other soul was out on the track. Right? And I walk out, and I think the session I'd been given was 5 times 300 meters. And I looked around, just like, oh my God, this is gonna be a drudge. So I'm like, okay, let's just get through it. And then I'm like halfway through my warm up, and I'm like, you know what? Maybe today I'll just do 3 times 300, just shorten it up. So I do some strides, I get back, and I'm stretching. I was just like, maybe I'll just warm up today. And I just stretch to the left, stretch to the right. You know what? I said, I'm going home. So it can be really lonely, and you know, without that accountability piece there, like your coach to say, hey, get on with it. It's really hard. And you never know how much to talk about. Like, some coaches don't necessarily understand mental health. And so they don't even know what to do if you are going through some stuff or feeling any type of way. I remember when I was training at in Bath, and this time I was quite deep into the experience of depression, right? And I thought I was doing well because I was on the antidepressants. I just started them. And this day I felt okay. And I went out, I did a training session. We did really well. I was, my coach was happy. I was happy. I mean, it felt like, okay, yeah, you know what? I'm going to get to this 2012 one way or another. And excuse me, I'm just going to blow my nose.
Yeah, of course.
Sinus issues.
Oh, no worries.
Everyone's like, no, it's COVID. No, it's sinus, promise. So my coach, we're happy. I did the workout, it was great. And I'm driving home and I'm feeling good about the session. And then out of nowhere, I just started crying my eyes out. And I was so angry because I said, you know what, God, if I cannot have a day where even when I'm happy, I can just be happy, like even when I'm happy, I feel the depression, then forget it. Like, there's no way I can't win this battle. Like, just forget about it. And so I had been prescribed, because I think a lot of people with depression also have the issue of insomnia. So I had been prescribed sleeping tablets for the insomnia, and I just got home and I just took them. I just took them all. And that was how I ended up in hospital. But, you know, it's that whole loneliness, you know, in that moment I felt alone. Like, I didn't think to say, okay, let me call and talk to someone, or I felt alone. And I think, again, it's because you don't always realize how many other people feel the exact same way, right? And once you realize what you're going through, that is depression, I think it's important to set up different, you know, points of contact. Okay, if I'm going through this, I'm going to call this person to talk to. Because once we start that conversation in our own heads with our own affected minds, we can't have a truly logical, rational conversation.
Of course, yeah, yeah, definitely.
So we're not the right person to talk to. Talking to ourselves is actually to our detriment. That's why it's so important. We have to have some lifelines, some friends, an organization, a 24-hour hotline number handy or whatever. Set those things up. I talk about I'm talking about goal setting and things like that, I talk about getting out ahead, getting out in front. As an athlete, that's what we do, right? We try to get out in front so we can cross the finish line first. And we do it in other areas of our lives. We get out in front of an issue. So we'll get health insurance so that if we get unhealthy or something happens, we're protected. We'll get car insurance in case we have an accident. We can get our car fixed. We have all these things to get out ahead, get out in front of an issue, except when we're dealing with our little goals and our little lives, we don't get out ahead, right? So we need to, once we realize we're in a spot or there is potential for a spot, and even before, like even with my goals, I'll say, I'm very aware that I won't feel like it all the time. I don't care what the goal is. Like, even then, I went to the track. This is my goal. I want to get to the Olympics. I want to get a medal. But yet when I got to the track, I didn't feel like it, right? It's called human nature. And there's a lot of science behind how the brain works and why that is, right? So we don't get our head. I didn't have a plan in place for if I didn't feel like it when I got to the track. So guess what? I went to whatever the brain wants to default do, which is get the heck out of Dodge, right? The same with this issue of mental health. Get out ahead. Once you realize, or if you know, you know, something may come up, or even before, like, what would I do if I was, you know, going through something like this? I would have this person as a connect. I would get that number. So if someone would have told me, hey, listen, even when you get on antidepressants, you may go through some ups and downs. When you do, have this in place, have this number handy, have this person to talk to, call me, whatever. That probably would have changed that whole situation, because I would have picked up the phone instead of just crying to myself, you know. I would have picked up the phone and said, hey, you know what, I'm feeling like what's the point? And I would have been able to have that conversation with a brain that has a rational process going on, which my brain didn't have at that time.
Yeah, that is such an amazing way to look at it. We haven't had anyone on who's put it quite like that. And to have multiple points just makes so much sense. You know, I've not heard that before, and I've not heard anyone talk about that before, but kind of like lights just gone on for me. That's really, really powerful. That, like, what a useful it's kind of like, I suppose, like loading the deck in your favor, isn't it? If you've got to play the hand that you're dealt, well, do everything you can to make sure that you stand a better chance. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
I love that. And the thing is, we are like, in the sense of our recovery, our strengthening of ourselves, we are actually at the core of it, because nobody can help us until we are allowing that help to come into play, right? So I say, you know, you are your knight in shining armor. Like, a lot of times we want people to save us, and it seems like they're saving us. So if I call that number, they're saving us, but it's not them that's saving us. It's me being open to the help that is saving me. It's me, I'm saving me. So that's why we have to set up our own help system. We have to be our own knight in shining armor. So we have to put things in place and create an environment where we can save ourselves. So when I realized I was in depression, and I knew I didn't want to stay there, because once I got on antidepressants, I, you know, and this is, whatever you need is what you need. But for myself personally, I decided I did not want to be a person who would need to be on antidepressants for the rest of my life. For some people, that's what you need. It's no judgment. But for me, that was a decision I made in my mind. I said, I'm going to use this as a crutch or a means to an end or a bridge to get myself to a place where I can actually do stuff like cook for myself or go outside and say hello, like to just get a bit more regular. Then I'm going to work at getting out of that, right? And so when I said that, I realized I had to fight for me. I had to fight to save my own life. I knew that this was a full-fledged battle against me, this part of me that was not healthy. It's literally, I had to see it almost like a war. So when I wasn't feeling right, I would not just kind of accept that as okay. I would inject, get in touch with, or start utilizing those things that getting out ahead that I had in place. But it's only because in those glimmering moments where you do feel okay, those are the moments that I used to start setting up how I was going to get myself to recover, how I was going to save myself, how I was going to try and win this battle against this mental health issue. And it, for everyone, it's different because it depends. I mean, everyone's gone through different levels, different ways that it affects them. But the more, it's kind of like meditation. Like, when people meditate, they first sit down, it's like, I can't just like get into this peaceful space. Like, I'm just, and the more you sit, the longer those peaceful moments become. So at first, you 10 seconds and you're already thinking about, oh yeah, you know, for lunch yesterday was really good, you know, and then the next thing you know, you realize, oh man, the time went by. I didn't even realize that much time went by. It's the same, like those moments of joy, those, they start to sort of open up the more that you start to train yourself. One tool that really, really helped me was gratitude. I had zero gratitude, and a lot of depression comes from that, because we feel like we don't have control. And we feel hopeless. And when we use gratitude, it starts to shift how we are seeing this picture, right? So when I was going through depression, I was like, oh, this guy is doing these horrible things to me in a relationship. My son is not here with me. My career is going terrible. I'm not making any money like I want to. I'm getting injured and I've lost my sponsorship, and like the whole world. in actual reality, my life was very freaking good. I was not homeless. I had a car to drive. I had people that loved me, but I couldn't see all that because the things that I was focused on weren't going the way I wanted them to. Once I started, saying, listen, I don't want to be on antidepressants for the rest of my life. I want to feel healthy, mentally, emotionally, and physically. And I started to use gratitude as a tool. It really changed the perspective. I started to appreciate more. And if you always remember that it could be worse, like you could live in a box, or you could have no box. You know, like there's always someone worse off than you. And I know that sometimes when you're feeling bad, that doesn't always help. It's like, yeah, but this is me and this is how I'm feeling. But if you do look at what you do have, it can really start to shift and raise your energy and raise your vibration and raise your level of happiness. And those little glimmers that you can start shifting that energy, that start to build, they're like a snowball. Like you spiral down. Like when I was getting depressed, I was spiraling down because the more things were bad, the more things were bad. But we can also train ourselves to spiral up by using different tools and techniques that help our minds start to focus on things that are good, things that raise our energy, things that make us feel better. And eventually, like I've never been in that space ever again since, because I recognize the signs now and I use the tools to spiral myself out. Like I say, oh, there you go. No, let's go back. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that self-awareness, being able to like tune into yourself, that's huge, right? That's, like you say, be able to spot things coming. And I love the idea of getting out in front of it and getting that control over it. And then if you have a good day, it's not a coincidence. It's not a luck. It's not luck, right? You've done that. And if you have a bad day, then you can analyze it and say, what have I been neglecting over the last like weeks and months? And why have I come to this point? Yeah, that's that's a fantastic way of looking at it. Yeah. And if we just rewind a little bit, Tasha, to after you had the baby, was the plan always to run again? Was that always on the cards? When did you make that decision?
When I was pregnant, I was crying in the shower and my husband came and got me out. It's gonna be all right. Then after I went, I got out the shower, I went on the internet and I said, let me torture myself some more and see what more horrible things people are saying. And I searched my name and I found this thing, and it was an award from an organization that promotes, you know, keeping your child, like anti-abortion or organization. And they had given me an award, like a literal physical award, but they didn't know me, so they couldn't get it to me or reach out to me. And they had awarded it to me unbeknownst to me. So I contacted them and I said, thank you, da 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 da, you know, and they said, no, it's actually a real award. We can send it to you. I was like, okay, great. I mean, I haven't had one of these before. And they said, we just had tons of letters of support, and they emailed those, they sent me those, they mailed all the letters, physical letters, people, you know, the snail mails, and they sent it all to me, and I read and I tried to reply to everyone. But that energy of seeing that it's not only the people who don't understand what's going on, the naysayers, there are a whole community of people who appreciate what you're doing, who can connect with what you're doing, who understand what you're going through and support you. And we are human beings, and as much as we say, oh, I don't need anybody helping me, I can do it all by myself and all this stuff, and you know, like I don't need someone's approval and I don't need validation from nobody, yeah, okay. We're all human and we're wired to want to connect, we're wired to want to belong, we're wired to want to be a part of something. And so when you feel like you've been ejected from your family, then you know it means a lot to connect with another group that you can identify with and identify with you. So it was it was tough out of that point. But once I started getting my energy back, because at first, when I first found out I'm pregnant, you know, and my husband and I had not brought it out to the media, we're like, well, we've seen people compete in pregnant before. I remember, you know, some people compete in 6 months pregnant, and like maybe that's an option, but yeah, once I got to 6 months, I was like, yeah, that's not happening. It's like my belly was out to 2 miles out, right? So but you know, it was once I sort of clicked out of feeling sorry for myself, for lack of a better phrase, I decided, yeah, like I do want my son to not feel like it's because of him that I didn't follow my dreams. I wanted to prove that I could. I believed it was possible. I felt like if I could train throughout my pregnancy and still stay healthy, which I would have wanted to do anyway, because I come from a sports background. So for sports people to just stop being physical because they're pregnant can actually be worse than staying physical. So then I said, yeah, we'll keep doing this. And the funny thing is, I trained and trained and trained. You know, I was at the gym on spinning class, and the teacher was like, you get out of here, not having any baby in my class. Eventually, when I got like so big, my legs were like out to the side. You know, I once got out of the pregnancy phase and Jaden was born, I went to the track for the first time, I think 4 months after having him, because, wow, you know, that was when you know, I felt like, you know, he would be okay and all that. I did one lap, Tom, seriously. I thought I was going to die.
Oh, no.
I've been training all this time and I did one lap. I thought I was going to die. I was like, oh, my God. And I think that's when I said to myself, you know what? If you are going to do this, you better be like super freaking dedicated, and you better mean that you want to do it and be serious, because this is going to be probably the hardest journey of your sports career that you've ever, ever endeavored, right? And so I said, okay, all right, I'll do it. And so from that point forward, I just kept climbing my way back.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And then of course, you know, that led to Beijing, right? That was 2008. Yeah
absolutely. Things, you know, kind of took a really nice smooth trajectory upwards until I actually got to 2008, and everything you could probably want to go wrong went wrong. It was like the best and the worst year of my life. Like, I was about to open up the season and I started having Achilles problems. I was like, oh my gosh. And prior to that, like, little weird things, like the certain really good athletes weren't making their teams and things like that. I'm like, maybe this is opening up the way for me to make my comeback. And then all these things started happening for me. I was like, okay, maybe it's opening the way for somebody else. So, you know, and I remember calling the UK and saying, hey, I need to get back. My Achilles, it just won't let up. So they got me back, worked on it. We got it right. First session out, I'm not even going fast. I'm just striding. I tore my hamstring, like a little, a low level tear, but a tear still. I was just like, what is going on? Got that healed up, trained, did biking and stuff for a while, and went out, did a session again. Still not going fast because it's the first session back. Tore my hamstring again. I was just like, what? Are my hamstrings made out of paper mache or something? Rice crackers? Or what? Was there any muscle in there even? You know? So that was super frustrating, because time is a ticking at this point. Because remember, when I first got the Achilles issue, it was already the opening of the season. It was like April, around April. So, you know, you only have until basically June, July to really show your stuff. Time is a ticking away. And we get to the national championships, and I really have not done any performance worth talking about. And at the time, it's Perry Shake Straighten and myself, and we are in a predicament. Well, we weren't, the selectors would be, because Perry had the standard, the B standard for the current year. For the Olympics, to go to the Olympics, they have a B standard and an A standard.
Right.
A is the faster standard, B is the slower standard. So Perry had the B standard for the current year. That means real time, she's doing good. I had the A standard from the previous year, but I haven't been running well this year. The rules say they can't take an A and a B. You either have to have two people that are running the A, or you have to have two people that are running the B to go. So they were going to have to choose between the two of us. And I went out, I was feeling good, But long story short, Perry won the Olympic trials. I came second. So I'm just looking at this like, this ain't happening. I've been running like crap. Perry's running well. She's young, up and coming. This is a no-brainer. They're going to pick Perry. But I just couldn't let it go. Like, I had been visualizing and seeing this in my mind that for so long. So even though I was a chocolate mess, I was just like, after I did not win, I was just crying my eyes out. Man, I sound like a really emotional person, but I don't cry that much. Nothing wrong with crying, by the way. It's a good emotion. After I picked myself up from that, I just, because you know, there's 7 days between when the end of the championships and when they announce who they picked. So it's like the longest 7 days of your life. And I just continued on as if I was going. And I continued on with my visualization. I had a song that would play over and over. It's by Busta Rhymes and Linkin Park. Together we made it. We made it even though we had our backs up against the wall. And I would just play that and play that and play that. And I would visualize myself crossing the Olympic final line and pointing up at my coach. We did it. And then on the seventh day, they called me. And they were like, you're sitting down. And long story short, they said, we picked you. They explained that, you know, my history of always performing when it mattered. And they'd spoken to the doctors and the doctors believed that I'd be all right for the games. That was why, you know, so just that history of persevering and, you know, being someone who would never give up. It spoke to where I was at the time. And that was like the money in the bank that I was able to cash at that moment.
Yeah, it's like
my Olympic dream.
Yeah, a lifetime of work just paid off then in that moment.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Fantastic. And you know, they made the right decision, eh? Because
Well, the team manager, when the list came out to the press, in the press, he got 42 texts within the first hour asking, why is Tasha Davis on the team?
Wow.
So that's how much they thought that I shouldn't be there versus, you know, maybe Perry or someone else. Well, no, there was no one else, but just versus Perry or just me not going at all. That's how strongly people felt. Like 42 texts, why is Tasha Davis on the team? That's a serious situation. So,
yeah.
You know, you can imagine as I went through the rounds, like no one expected me to be on the team, first of all. Then to get out of the heats was like, whoa, okay. And then I made the semifinal. And they were like, okay, yeah, probably semifinal, but she won't make the final. And then I made the final and it's like, wow, what a phenomenal story. And I remember speaking to one of the gentlemen that worked up at Lee Valley, which I was training at the time. And he said, you have no idea what it was like when you crossed that line and you got that bronze. I said, what happened? He said, listen, we love Christine Ogakuru. We love her. And when she crossed the line, we all cheered. But when you came across that line and you got that bronze, it's like the roof came off the place because we all knew the journey that you had been on to get that. And it was just an amazing thing. And it was amazing. It did feel amazing.
Yeah. I watched it this morning on YouTube in preparation for this. And it felt watching it just on YouTube like it was live, like it was live on a Saturday night. You know, even now it's like incredibly powerful. Yeah, it was brilliant.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes I get goosebumps when I'm watching myself, like, come on. Like, girl, that was so long ago. What are you doing?
Was there is there any sort of, from a mental perspective, like a come down after that, Tasha? You focus on that for so long, you overcome so much, and then the next day you wake up and you've got your medal, but you're just like, Tasha, you're a mum, you know, doing mum stuff and, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, the podium I thought was going to feel different. I thought it was going to be like, I just don't know what I thought, but it felt very like almost bland, like, okay, standing on a box kind of feeling. And but all the depression and everything that I wanted to be done, I think, with sports. And I didn't want to admit it to myself because the Olympics were coming in 2012. So I was kind of forcing myself into a box that I really probably shouldn't have been in. I really wanted to be done with sports at that time. But to me, it doesn't make sense. Like, the next Olympics are in your home city. I mean, this could change your life completely if you do well there. Like, that's a whole nother level of Olympics when you have not only Olympics in your country, the Olympics is in the city you were born in. And it's also during a time when you can actually have the possibility to compete. Like, this doesn't happen for a lot of people. This is like a once in a generation, you know, multiple generation opportunity. So I think I kind of forced myself to sit in that box, but really I had already emotionally checked out. I was forcing it. And so there, you know, along with my husband in 2008 was my coach, and we were going through a divorce during those games. So you can imagine that was the beginning of things starting to shift downwards. 2009, because the Olympics were in London in 2012, I decided to move back to London. So now I'm like shifting my life. My son came with me but didn't like it, so we let him go back with his father. So that separation from my son. And so you can see these events are starting to shape my mentality, because I'm seeing them rather than the, you know, the positives in my life. And that's where the depression cycle started to go. So that whole story that I told you about being on the antidepressants and that whole journey happened post 2008.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until 2000, I think probably 2011 and 12, where I started to really fight to you know, get off. Because I think we went, I got on antidepressants maybe in 2011 or 10, somewhere around there. And then from that point, that's where the challenge started. So it was after 2008 that this all happened. And you know, it's just this difficult position for the athlete, for the coach. You know, my coach knew I was on antidepressants once I got on them, and it's like he doesn't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know, like, because I would feel, my body would feel so weird at times. I was like, is this old age? Like, am I getting too old for the sport, or is this the drugs making me feel like that? I had no information to base how I was feeling off. This is a really challenging time. But yeah, that was all after the Olympics. Yeah. And that's another way that I say living. So I say live above the line. I also say live beyond the line. So living beyond the line is when you look at life beyond the goal. And a lot of people do not have a goal past the goal. So they get here and it's like, oh, I said I was going to go to the forest, but now I'm here. What do I do?
Yeah.
It's like nothing to live for anymore because they haven't had a goal. It's like, okay. So along the way, when you're getting closer to accomplishing your goal, I think it's really important to, number one, understand why. Why do you even want this goal? And I always say, have two reasons, have two whys, have two passions about your goal. So one is personal and one is purposeful, right? So you say, my personal goal. So like, my personal goal when I was training was that I would finish every workout, no matter what, even I had to walk over the line. That's not some big grandiose, like for the world type of goal, but it was meaningful to me. Purposeful was I knew that if I did well, I would have a platform like this. People would want to speak to me. I could pass on the messages, the wisdom, the things that I'd learned through my experience that I know can help other people with theirs. I knew that that would be a possibility. That was my purposeful goal. Now, when I am doing a training session and I'm like dead, like I can't go anymore, and my coach says, oh, by the way, you got one more 600. You think I could care less? Like, let's be real. You think I could care less about inspiring people at that moment? You guys figure it out yourselves. Good luck. I don't care. I'm done. Just get me out of this situation, right? So I can't use that super inspirational goal to motivate me in that moment. So I need that personal goal, the one that says, okay, you said, though, you're going to finish every workout. Ah, okay, you got me, right? Whereas when I'm looking at opportunities, so someone says, can I interview you? And I look at who their audience is and they're like, okay, yeah, this is in alignment with my purposeful goal. I can have the opportunity to inspire, touch, and bless others with the lessons I will share and the things I will also learn from them. So I say having that those two whys is also important for feeding into that goal. So yeah. I have that in place in order to really help move forward.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love the way you can use that as well to make sure that you're doing stuff that aligns with you, you know, because that's huge, you know. But like you mentioned before, trying to push yourself into a box that you didn't really want to be in, you know. And yeah, you can only
absolutely. Like I'm a certified passion test facilitator. And one of the reasons why I chose to become one is because I really began as I got older and older, especially post sports, as I transitioned out of sports, how important clarity was. And doing the passion test really gives people the clarity that they need. Because a lot of times we think we know what we want. Hey, yeah, I want to go to 2012. Do you though? Do you really though? You know, and then what it does, it gets you to be very clear with no isms and asms, because, you know, you'll have people say, well, my kids should be on top of the list. You know, isn't that what a mother should be? Like, shouldn't your kids be at the top of your list of passions? No, it's not how it works. You have to do it based on what is your instinct telling you, because at the end of the day, when you are good, I remember another passion test facilitator that works with Jack Canfield. She said, when you choose, you're not choosing against them. You're choosing for you, right? And when you are good, they're going to be okay anyway, because you're just going to be a better person in general. So I do the passion test with people because it's so important. I realize the importance of having that really sharp clarity. And when I retired, that was what I was missing. I didn't know what I wanted to do, where I was going to go, how I was going to do it, any of that stuff. Zero clarity whatsoever. And when I came across the passion test, I was like, okay, this is something that is helpful. And that's why I teach it now and I do it with people now, because I'm just like, this clarity, like knowing what you do, like how can you make choices when you don't even really know what you want? Right. So what happens is with a passion test, you identify what are the most meaningful things for you right now. And you align your life with those things. So whenever you have a choice, an opportunity, a decision, you base it off of, you choose in favor of your passions, basically. Yeah. And so once you know what they are, you can do that. But if you don't have that tool, you're kind of like, oh, should I do this? Should I? Like I did so many things I had no business doing because I had no clarity. And so clarity really is the seed of everything that you need in order to become your best self.
Yeah, that is huge. Yeah, because I've, you know, I suppose if you don't have that, it's so easy to get, you know, like we subconsciously just start doing the societal norms, right? Stuff that might not suit us or work for us, but we do it because everyone else does. And it's kind of what you think you're supposed to do. And yeah, just go there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. Because there is that much pressure.
Yeah, yeah. Did you start to build all this stuff as part of your rebuild, Tasha, when you sort of you got to that point where things couldn't really get any worse and you started to, you know, make that comeback, you know, work to get in better, getting to where you are now? Is this how you like figured this stuff out on that journey?
You know, I think I've always been a growth fan. I've always been a fan of growing. I've always been a fan of getting better and figuring out what are the little hacks, what are the tools, why is this person successful, this person not. I mean, I'll watch crime TV and people are like, why do you watch that stuff? I'm just like looking at people's minds. Why did they end up like that? What caught, you know? And I like justice as well. I like to see when they get caught, but that's a whole other show. You know, but it built, because I remember even having, when I was in college still, I had like the huge Tony Robbins course, like when it was still like, was it CDs or tapes? I don't know, but the thing is like open like a castle. You know? It was that big back then. Now they just send you some digital downloads. But I kind of always have been like that. But yeah, I think probably after that, I really probably got even more locked into learning what made people successful. Because while I was going through my career, I did not identify those as anything significant, because it's just what we did and everybody in my environment behaved the same. But it was post-career, like trying to get work and people saying, well, your skills as an athlete are transferable, you know, people are looking for people who are like this. So that's when I began to say that success has a blueprint. So it doesn't matter if you apply that blueprint to a job, you know, or a sports career, whatever it is, it has a blueprint. There are certain particular things, particular behaviors, particular mindsets that people who are successful and uber successful have. And if you can learn how to apply them to whatever it is you're going after, you can have whatever success means to you.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's I always say success leaves clues. And you know, there are certain techniques that people use and certain things that people do, whether they're like successful people or just people that are happy, people that have dealt with some of these dark places and that are able to hold it together. Yeah. And stuff like you've mentioned so many of them today, Tasha, you know, stuff like gratitude, meditation, alignment, all these words, Matt. And it is no coincidence that someone like yourself is using them and that like other people are using them too, you know. And I think that's so great that people listening can hear that and start to think, how can I apply that to my current situation? How can I get control of this? I think that's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Is that predominantly your work now, Tasha? Because I know you do a lot of things, don't you? But you work with people to
Yeah, I'm Jamaican, so it's part of my DNA apparently to try and do 28 things at once. But yeah, you know, it's definitely working with people. And, you know, I was blessed with the opportunity to be able to achieve my dream. And I feel like it's important for people to recognize it. What is it you dream of? It takes just as much energy to accomplish a small dream as it does to accomplish a big dream. So why not dream big and see where you land? You know, I talk about I'm just actually setting up to do some experiences for Airbnb. They have Olympic experiences and regular experiences. So I'm going to be a part of the Olympian experiences. And one of the things I have in my presentation is just talking about, you know, dreaming big. You know, how do you prepare to dream big? How do you prepare to win big? You know, and win, what's important now? Like, what's important now? How can you win? And I think if we constantly ask ourselves that question, it helps us continue to stay aligned, like you talked about, with what it is that we're accomplishing. But we have to first get to the beginning, you know, make sure that the thing that we're starting, that our starting point is the right starting point. And sometimes a lot of people don't even know how to figure out, like, I don't know what I want to do. Or I have so many things I want to do, I don't know which one to start. So they can be on the spectrum of so many things they can't figure out, or absolutely no motivation for nothing and everything in between. But there are tools that you can use to sort of, you know, sometimes through a process of elimination. Like, for example, one thing I might use working with people, working with clients is the opposite. So, for example, they'll say to me, well, I don't want to be broke. Okay. You don't know what you want to earn, but you know you don't want to be broke. That's a starting place, right? So we can work from there. You say, okay, well, if you don't want to be broke, if I give you $100 or £100 a month, is that cool? No, that would still be broke to me. So now we start looking at information and start building into what it is you want, right? So you start getting a clear picture. So then we get to, all right, £2,000 a month would be okay for you. Okay, now we have something. I want to earn an income of £2,000 a month after taxes. That is a very clear, precise goal. Like, okay, would you be okay stripping to get it? Oh, no, I'm not really into stripping. Okay, what about truck driving? No, not really truck driver. All right, what about if you, what are you passionate about? Like, do you like singing? No, I'm not really into singing, but I do like sometimes I could just doodle all day long and never stop. I like just drawing stuff. Okay, so if you could earn $2,000 a month doing art, would that be something that would work for you? Yeah, my God, if I could just like do art all day long. So now we start to see what resonates. And then you have a starting point. And so you can start to gain clarity. But if you do not have clarity about what it is you want to achieve, if you have any questions, clarity should be your number one goal before anything else. Like, gaining clarity on who I am and what I want to accomplish should be what your goal actually is. And then once you have that clarity, you can go after the actual goal, if that makes sense.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I think, I mean, that's such a cool place to end on. here, Tasha. But yeah, just to whip that round from mental health, you know, and I love the fact that you can talk about your experiences and then talk about, you know, it's not just about kind of just doing okay, you know, it's about getting okay and then building on it and then doing the things that you're talking now to just go on and you know, yeah, actually really do something that you want to do. And you know, we don't just have to like make it through with this stuff, right? There's real hope that, you know, we can get better and we can build, and if we do the things and do the work and try and all that sort of stuff, that we can do all right, you know. Huh?
Absolutely. Yeah. First level, you know, you may have to survive, but you can survive, and then we thrive. Right? We just shift out of survival mode into thriving mode. And that's really where the essence of life is. Because let me just say to everybody, every single person on this planet has a gift, a talent that they should be sharing with someone other than themselves. Our number one job in life is to figure out what that is and get it out, get it to the world. Now, it could be it's your mothering skills, and your gift is to share that with your children. It could be that you are, you know, like I went to the courthouse when I was going through my divorce, and there was a woman behind the front desk, and her demeanor, her manner with the people who were coming in with all these different issues was just so perfect. And I would never think of having that job. I would never want to be sitting behind a desk, but she made it hers. She made it her own because that was her talent, communication, dealing with people, right? So find your talent, right? Look at what you have, right? When you start to feel those down moments, look at what you have. Make gratitude a part of your everyday life. When I wake up, at bare minimum, I always write down three things I'm grateful for. I have a diary that there's even a space. It says, what are you grateful for? I write three things down every single day and at night as well. So make it a part of your everyday life and you'll start to see those things shifting. But just know, no matter how you feel right now, there's something you're here for. There's something you are here to offer the world. It's your job to figure it out. And, you know, if you need help and support in finding you first so that you can be of service to the world, then do what you have to do to get to that space. But when you start sharing and giving to the world, all the problems don't seem so bad.
Oh, mate, that's awesome. Yeah, what a cracking. We'll sign off on that, Tasha, if that's the right view. That's brilliant. Yeah, thank you so much for your time. I do apologize. I'm pretty much sat here in the dark right now. It looks so weird on the video. God, I'm just disappearing. But I really didn't want to get up and put a light on and interrupt you. That was brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. Yeah. I really, really all appreciate right. it.
From light to dark and dark to light.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Tasha. So I'm just going to hit record.
Thank you for listening from the Proper Mental Podcast. Please like and subscribe.
Plus 5 stars.